Both men, and flight engineer Robert Arnholt, saw it silhouetted against the moon in the shape of a torpedo or submarine, except that there were no protruding fins or external structure. It appeared to be perfectly streamlined, but its color could not be determined, it appearing black against the moon. Compared to jet aircraft speed, it was fantastically greater. It passed out of sight in the east in only 1 minute. When the object first appeared, Sperry started a turn to the right, then when it changed its course to one paralleling the DC-6, Sperry turned to the left so as to be able to follow its path. Even so, it went to the rear of the plane, circled around to the right far enough so the Gates saw it on his side before reversing its direction and going out of sight to the east. June 22, 1950, three Air Force men, Corporal Garland L. Pryor of Whitehall, Montana, Staff Sergeant Ellis Lorimer and Staff Sergeant Virgil Caporo of San Leandro, California, saw a flying ice cream cone streak across the sky at Hamilton Field three times. It was visible on as a cone-shaped blue-white flame. The of Hamilton Field control tower lists it only as an unknown object traveling at a very high rate of speed, 1,000 to 1,500 miles per hour at an elevation of between 2,000 and 5,000 feet. June 26, 1950, Captain E. L. Rimlin and First Officer David Stewart, and Observer Captain Sam B. Wiper observed a mysterious object while flying their AL mainliner at 14,000 feet between Las Vegas and the Silver Lake checkpoint 8 miles north of Baker, New Mexico. It had a bluish center with a bright orange tint and was flying horizontally at about 20,000 feet, much faster than the mainliner. It was about 20 miles distant. It was also seen by Las Vegas carmen and reported by an Air Force and a Navy plane in the general area. June 29, 1950, Hubert Hutt, post office worker at Fort Collins, Colorado, saw an object in the sky at 9:40 a.m. which appeared simultaneously with an airliner at about 3,000 elevation. It was at about 4,500 feet, traveling northwest. It looked like a silvery snowball and looked as though it were circled by a kind of ring. It was extremely maneuverable. July 9, 1950, John Sokol, 1018 Outer Drive, Cold Brook, PA, saw a strange white column at about 5,000 feet elevation. At 2:30 p.m. it seemed to be hovering over the Schenectady General Depot, U.S. Army. Sokol went to the police station and called the cylinder to the attention of patrolmen Edward Harrison and James Hill. They saw something that looked like a huge cigarette suspended from a cloud bank. The object definitely had substance, and was not smoke or a cloud formation. The police notified county airport officials who stated an investigation was being launched by fighter planes of the Air National Guard. Later, planes were observed circling the strange cylinder, emitting black smoke which etched a circle around the white object. At 4:20 p.m. the planes were still circling the object. When next the police looked, the object was gone, but the planes still circled. Air National Guard officials commented, "No comment." July 13, 1950, Dr. C. L. Quixley, Ocala, Florida, reported 12 or 13 flying saucers over his Greenville Terrace home about 8:45 a.m. They were round and sort of opalescent like soap bubbles. They were traveling about 10 in a line, with three off to one side in a checkmark formation. They came in from there, northeast toward Jacksonville, and played around in a circle, then disappeared toward the southwest. They sounded a little like an ordinary plane in a dive, but more shrill. July 29, 1950, Jim Graham, chief test pilot for Capital Aviation Company of Springfield, Illinois, reported his plane struck by a mysterious object which looked like a blue streak and had a trail of reddish flame. The object hit his propeller and then suddenly there was the brightest light he had ever seen in his life. There was no sound and it did not rock his plane. There was no damage to his craft. The occurrence was at midnight in clear weather. Four other Springfield residents volunteered independently that they had seen a mysterious streak in the sky. August 12, 1950, William Skirk, Yuma, Colorado, saw, along with dozens of other persons in Main Street, a dark disc-shaped object with a dim glow around its rim. When it reached a point just above a drugstore, it abruptly ceased lateral flight and sliced straight upward, disappearing behind low-hanging clouds. September 10, 1950, Lieutenant Wilbert S. Rogers and Captain Edward Ballard, Mitchell Field, New York, Air Force jet pilots, chased a mysterious round flying object for 30 miles and couldn't catch it. They estimated its speed at 900 miles per hour. They sighted the object over Sandy Hook, New Jersey, while on a routine flight in a T-33 jet plane. It was white, or silver-colored and about the size of the fighter plane. When they sighted the object, they were traveling at 450 miles per hour at 20,000 feet. November 21, 1950, Perry Torbogson and Jack Anderson, both on the editorial staff of the Columbia Basin News at Pasco, Washington, watched an object in the sky for 8 minutes. It was a shiny, cigar-shaped object in the vicinity of the Hanford Atomic Plant near sundown. It was shaped like a cigar and glistened brightly. Pasco's downtown streets were packed with people watching the object. It disappeared on a southwesterly course. It stopped and hung in the air over the plant. December 7, 1950, observed by Guy Fawkes, for example, painter, John Smith, Lovin Horrocks, Joe McMullen, Doc Rasmussen and Joe Shalev-Rangeley. Oklahoma, 2 January 1951, Captain Larry W. Vinther and co-pilot James F. Bachmier, flying a Mi-Continent airline plane, saw a strange object over Sioux City, Iowa. The object had straight wings, no exhaust glow and no jet pods or engines visible. Vinther was on the ground getting tower clearance for takeoff when the tower asked him to check on a strange light in the sky. After takeoff, Vinther spotted the light and climbed toward it. He was a plane which had an unknown kind of navigation lights in addition to a strong white light underneath its fuselage. The object's light all blinked on and off 5 or 6 times as the two craft drew close to each other, approaching from opposite directions. Vinther had just turned his head from watching the ship go past his wing when there it was again, flying right behind him about 200 feet to the left and going in the same direction. Said Vinther, "You just can't turn an airplane around that fast at that speed." The strange plane flew alongside for about 4 seconds, then dropped down and was lost from sight. A shining aluminum-colored object hovered for more than a minute over the oil basin, then moved rapidly to the east. It was a flat, disc-like object which seemed to rotate as it hovered and on top had a dome-like structure. At regular intervals a flash seemed to come from the object. Altitude was approximately 2,000 feet in a clear, blue sky. February 14, 1951, Captain J. E. Cocker, All-Weather Flying Division, and Captain E. W. Spridley, Aerial Photographic Division, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, while tracking a large weather balloon, saw an object hovering at 50-60,000 feet. It was flat and looked like a dime. It was a milky color. Just before it disappeared there were 3 brilliant flashes, like photo flashes. August 27, 1951, Dr. W. L. Ducker, head of the Texas Tech College Petroleum Engineering Department, and Dr. A. G. Burt, professor of chemical engineering, and Dr. W. A. I. Robinson, professor of geology, all saw 2 strange formations like strings of beads in crescent shape, hurtling through the sky over Lubbock, Texas, at a speed which carried them from horizon to horizon in 3 seconds. They felt no shock waves, indicating the apparent formation was in the stratosphere, 50,000 feet above the Earth or higher. 2 Regarding the location, Rangeley, Oklahoma, no such place exists, even allowing for mistakes in spelling 147. They estimated the speed must have been 1,800 miles per hour if the objects were a mile high. If they were at 50,000 feet, the speed must have been 18,000 miles per hour. Shape could not be determined, but each gave off a glow as of reflected light. September 11, 1951, Lieutenant Wilbert S. Rogers, Mitchell Air Force Base, New York, saw a round object speeding about 900 miles per hour over the New Jersey coastline. Chapter 12. Analysis versus Opinion. What are the flying saucers? That is the big question in the minds of a great many people. That they are real is not a matter for conjecture. The evidence presented in this book precludes that. They can be accepted by even the most skeptical as a factual phenomenon. In this report, great care has been used to avoid the faults of other writers on the subject, whose use of fiction has been no worse than their misuse of the facts, and even the deliberate twisting of those facts to suit their own hypotheses. We have presented no theory, we have presented no report that cannot be substantiated by witnesses whose word is valid. Best of all, we have presented those photographs which it was possible to obtain, and though none of them offer the degree of detail necessary to be indisputable evidence in themselves, they are conclusive when coupled with the testimony of those who snapped the pictures and of the witnesses with them at the time. The difficulty of photographing an aerial object, even an ordinary plane, with the average person's camera is well understood, and when the element of surprise is present, it is well nigh impossible. The presence of any image at all is distinctly a lucky happenstance. There are several things that the saucers are not. They are not the product of the United States military arm. If the military of this country possesses an aircraft designed on the principle of the flying disc, it is a secret development designed and produced since the first discs were sighted in 1947, that is, those firsts which resulted in the sensational news headlines of June and July of that year. Nothing is known of such a development, and any conjecture about it would be both fruitless and silly. They are not a development of the Russian government, and for much the same reasons. Nor are we theorizing as to whether they have since imitated them. We can only hope that they have not been successful in any such attempt. They represent an advance in mechanical science far beyond the ability of any other nation, and cannot be theorized as being a product of any of them. This includes such nations as Spain and Argentina, both of which have been the subject of much imaginary hot air. No astronomer has yet substantiated the claims of those who say that they are from another planet, or even another solar system. All reports concerning disks that have crashed with little men in them have been impossible to substantiate. In each instance, those purveying such stories have balked when their source had been demanded. The material in this book is evidential. It is by no means complete. There are many thousands of reputable sightings. We, ourselves, have seen them on 11 different occasions. 3 sets of Kodachrome movies have been made by us of mysterious objects in the sky, none of them capable of being reproduced in this book. In fact, the objects themselves can only be seen in the film by means of a magnifying glass, or when projected on a fine screen. Taken by themselves, they are worthless, since a reflection from an ordinary plane could account for the flashes on the film. Yet the performance of the objects during the filming, and before and after, do not allow for such a prosaic interpretation. Most recent report, prior to the publication of this volume, is the report from Korea, from our own Army Intelligence, which is as follows. Objects. Globe or disc-shaped, bright orange in color and sending off occasional flashes of bluish light, were seen by crew members of 2 B-29 bombers at widely separated points around midnight on January 29, 1952. One sighting was over Wonsan, the other over Sungen. 2 crew members in each plane made the sighting and confirmed each other's observations. The Wonsan objects flew alongside the plane for 5 minutes, while the Sungen discs flew parallel to the B-29 for 1 minute. The impression of both crews was that the objects were globular. No attempt has been made by the Air Force to discount the sightings, but full investigations were said to have been instituted. The results of those investigations have not been revealed. On February 3, 1952, 6 days after the Korean sightings, Ray Palmer, one of the compilers of this book, sighted an object at 10 seconds past 6 p.m. CST. The time was determined through the coincidence of checking on the local FM station as to whether or not its 6 p.m. program would begin on the second. It did not. It was 5 seconds late. And 5 seconds later, the author was facing the row of windows which give a view towards Spring Creek, which flows directly past his home. Across the creek, some 300 feet from the house, along a private roadway which runs east to west, an orange globe, emitting blue flashes, sped past at approximately 180 miles per hour, determined later by measurement of the course over which it flew and the time in view. It was approximately 15 feet off the ground and passed between a slope in the background and the trunks of large trees in the foreground. The object was approximately the size of a basketball, and the light it emitted illuminated the ground beneath it and the slope behind it. The appearance of the glove was suggestive of the exhaust of a jet or rocket, although it left no train behind it, nor did it seem elongated as might be expected of such a method of propulsion. If an object was being propelled by the orange, globular glow, it was not visible. Whether this object was identical to those seen by the bomber crews over Korea cannot be determined, as no factual data can be obtained from that source. Only one fact is important: there can be no orange discs or globes which emit blue flashes traveling through the air of this planet in more than one place. Thousands of people have seen strange things in the sky, and sightings are continuing at the rate of as many as 12 each month, according to those officially recognized and reported by our intelligence services, and at a very much greater rate as determined by individual reports which sift through to us from all sources. How many sightings are not reported cannot be estimated. Certainly there are many. What are the flying discs? We are hardly so brash as to say. But keep your weather eye aloft and keep your camera handy. You may be the one to secure the information necessary to answer the greatest question of our day. And when you develop your film, if you see the insignia of either the United States or the Soviet Air Force on the objects you have captured with your lens, turn them over to the nearest military intelligence branch and keep your mouth shut about them. It'll save you a lot of trouble. Besides, they wouldn't be the flying saucers we're talking about. But if you photograph any little men, send the photo to us. We'll print it in a new book we're preparing in which factual data about a lot of things is badly needed. Chapter 13, Camera Story of the Saucers. The following 32 pages contain reproductions of all the photographs it is possible for a private citizen to obtain. In almost all cases, these original negatives were picked up by various intelligence agencies and are no longer available. Some of the photos we have reproduced from copies of the newspapers in which they were originally published, and are the only prints possible to obtain, and in each case the newspaper has informed us that they do not have the original negative or the print from which the cut was made, the cut itself, or any knowledge of the whereabouts of the person who made the photograph. In short, they are keeping their noses clean. The mere fact that Project Saucer teams have investigated the sighting, appropriated the photos, and left an air of mystery behind them has convinced them to let well enough alone. Not all of the photos can be vouched for as authentic, but where such is the case, we have so indicated. Yet there are many which we positively state are authentic. Two, in particular, are those which Brown and Davidson told Kenneth Arnold in Tacoma, the night of their deaths, were authentic and which later were shown to be him at Hamilton Field when their files were thrown open to his inspection. However, the photos reproduced in this book are the originals obtained from Mr. Rhodes in Phoenix, Arizona, days before Project Saucer teams arrived on the scene. We can vouch for the fact that they have not been retouched. None of the photos in this volume have been retouched or been made artificially more apparent in any way. Consequently, none of them can be said to be prize-winning examples of either the photographer's or the engraver's art. We present them only for what they are worth, and as proof that at least 32 of the saucer sightings have been also captured by the lens, scientific proof that the observers were not seeing blood corpuscles in their own eyes. Kenneth Arnold, Boise, Idaho's famous flying salesman, who first launched the story of the flying discs to national prominence with his able observation. He is shown here with the camera with which he later secured three separate films of flying discs to back up his story. Unperturbed by his great adventure, he is still selling fire apparatus. This is a photo of a model of the strange disc Arnold saw over the Cascades, June 1947. Captain E.J. Smith, Kenneth Arnold and co-pilot Ralph Stevens, in Seattle, Washington, where they compared notes on their individual sightings of flying discs which launched 1947's Big Story. Ray Palmer, co-author of this book, sighted his first flying saucer in 1939 in Chicago. It was a brilliant silvery disc, apparently at an elevation of some 5,000 feet, directly west of Chicago's Loop. It hung in the sky for more than 45 minutes and was witnessed by more than 100 people in the office building where he was located. Latest sighting was February 4, 1952, near Amherst, Wisconsin, an orange globe identical to those seen by the Air Force January 29, in Korea. He is a publisher of pulp magazines and books. The upper photo on page 164 shows the historic saucer which caused the censorship on July 10, 1947, halting its publication in all the nation's dailies just when the public was demanding proof of flying saucers. It was taken by William A. Rhodes, 4333 North 14th Street, Phoenix, Arizona. He was on his way to his rear yard workshop when he heard a whoosh, and snatching his camera, got a picture of the object at 1,000 feet. He used a box camera. Lower photo on page 164 shows the second film exposed by Rhodes, as the disc made a tight turn and came back over his house. I continued in a clockwise movement over his home, then disappeared to the west. As it disappeared, it did a phenomenal wing over and show straight up into the ether at incredible speed, a maneuver no living pilot could have endured. In its second pass over the house, the object made absolutely no sound. Kenneth Arnold, shown beside the plane used when he first saw discs. Paul Trent, Route 3, McMinnville, Oregon, capture this photo on this page and on page 167 on May 11, 1950. Said Trent's wife, Evelyn, "I was getting along toward evening about a quarter to eight. We'd been out in the backyard. Both of us saw the object at the same time. The camera. Paul thought it was in the car, but I was sure it was in the house. I was right, and the Kodak was loaded with film. Paul took the first picture. The object was coming in towards us and seemed to be tipped up a bit. It was very bright, almost silvery, and there was no noise or smoke." Trent explained that he took the first picture, rewound his film as fast as possible and then, as the object gathered speed and turned toward the northwest, he had to move rapidly to his right to get the second picture. Both were snapped within 30 seconds, he estimated. Neither Trent nor his wife would hazard a guess as to size, speed, distance. "It was moving awfully fast, is all I know," said Trent. Both photos clearly indicate a superstructure, and the photo on page 167 resembles the flying submarine seen over the Cascade Mountains in 1949. Experts insist that there has been no tampering with the negatives of Trent's pictures and that there is no possibility of a hoax connected with them. Trent's negatives were developed by a local firm in McMinnville. The Acme photo on page 167 shows Earl Baker, Kokomo, Indiana, pointing to the spot in the sky where he saw an object identical with the McMinnville saucer hover for 2 minutes at between 200 and 300 feet. He is holding an artist's sketch of the object, which had a conning tower, portals emanating blue light. On July 30, 1947, Johnny Ostrom, Nissa, Oregon, was driving his lumber truck along the road 1 mile north of Tamarack, Idaho at about 45 miles per hour when he saw, approaching at a 30-degree slant from the sky, a silver ball, extremely brilliant and blinding. Ostrom was sure that it would strike his truck and instinctively let loose of the wheel and in terror covered his face with his hands. The object, apparently the size of a baseball, struck the top of the truck at the front of the cab, see photo, and glanced off. When Ostrom removed his hands from his eyes, he brought his truck to a half some 100 yards down the highway. Here he got out and examined the truck. Where the object had hit was a scorched spot the size of a silver dollar, and it appeared that the metal had been melted, although there was no hole. The spot showed the characteristics of a weld, as though someone had patched a hole in the metal. Experts who examined it later said it was a weld, but Ostrom insisted no welding had been done on the truck and that the molten effect could have come only from the object's contact with the cab roof. Ostrom, who is 66, is highly regarded by long-time residents of the area, all of whom vouch for his integrity. Proof of an engineering nature that the flying saucer is capable of flight is offered in this Acme photo, which shows Dr. E.W.K. of Glendale, California, demonstrating his model flying disc, which he believes will revolutionize aviation. His 41-inch, 0.20-pound test model gets off the ground and spins in a 36-foot circle at 72 miles per hour. Vanes on the disc's rim open by centrifugal force when the disc rotates, making it act like a helicopter. At a sufficient altitude, the vanes are closed and it scoots away like a spinning top. Dr. K's model was tested before U.S. Air Force officials at his plant, who were greatly impressed. Dr. K estimates that a jet-powered disc 18 feet in diameter could rise like a helicopter and fly forward at 400 miles per hour. The wide rim would rotate at 500 revolutions per minute, but the cabin fuselage would not spin. Construction of an 18-foot, one-man disc is planned by Dr. K, and he believes his disc could be constructed as large as 50 feet in diameter. The above photograph was taken by Raymond Johnson of Toronto, Canada, and is reproduced from the Globe and Mail, which regrets that it cannot furnish the address of the photographer. Date, September 14, 1947. Disc was yellow with a tail. Time of passage was 15 seconds. The photo on page 171 was taken by Charles Shangel, Boise, Idaho, August 13, 1947. He was watching the sky when he saw a luminous object traveling slowly through the air at a great height. Rushing into the house, he secured his camera, and had time for one show before the object disappeared. It is visible in the upper left-hand corner of the photo as a very faint gray dot surrounded by a slight halo effect. This triangular object was photographed by Lloyd Sanders, Wright 1, Box 344, Battle Creek, Michigan, June 17, 1949. When sighted, the object was going up at a tremendous rate of speed, and it glowed like the sun. There was a high-pitched whining sound. The photo above is reproduced by courtesy of International News Photos and was taken by Bob Young at Catalina Island. The disc registers clearly on the photo, just above the funnel of a steamship in the immediate foreground. 1.jpg. This photo is from the Burley, Idaho Herald Bulletin, and is reproduced from the newspaper, as no prints are available. The smudges are glue marks. Photo made in East Park, Burley, believed to be a fake. Al Hickson Bohr, Louisville Times, key. Photographer took this picture at 10:15 p.m. Central Standard Time on July 7, 1947. There were three of the objects in the sky, but he had time to photograph only two of them. He makes no effort to say what the objects might be. They made no sound. John H. Jansen, while driving to the Morristown, NJ airport at 10 a.m. July 10, 1947, saw these four objects in the skies and got out of his car to photograph them. They appeared to be about 10,000 feet in the air. Three of the saucers were silvery white and the fourth was a dull, metallic color. They flew rapidly in formation, and disappeared toward New York City. In leaving the scene, they put on a burst of speed far in excess of any jet plane Jansen had ever seen. Censorship, next day, kept the photo out of other dailies. When Ira Maxey, Fort Worth, Texas, saw strange objects flying over his home, he took this picture. It is evidence that the images shown here are not due to creasing of the negative during development, as claimed for the photo on page 182, as they were visible to the eye as well as the camera. 2. JPG.